I'm Shorty, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm the radio.
And I'm the secretary of the Sunday night group in Kennewick, Washington. And if I can drive 1,200 miles down here to talk to you, the least you can do is come to our meetings once in a while. When Carl talked to me about coming down here and talking, he sounded kind of like he was scraping the bottom of the barrel. And somebody was classifying speeches, the different one made, and like Dick and Gladys this afternoon, they'd have to be classed among the tops when it come to a married couple speaking. And I'm sure Jim over there ranked pretty high along spiritual lines. But the only thing I could think of for them asking me was that possibly my speeches have more room for improvement than anybody else's had. This is the shortest introduction I think I've ever had. And I've had some doozies given me, too. I think you should know a little bit about your speaker. We know we belong to AA. We know lots about it. Sometimes we don't even know what they do for a living. I think you should know that. Jim lets you know what he was doing. Dick lets you know what he does for a living. Well, as far as you women are concerned, I'm an athletic equipment salesman. But as far as you men are concerned, I'm a jockstrap peddler. And I lived in a little town called White Salmon, Washington, and I lived there for 12 years. And I've been a stickler about anonymity. Somehow or other, I've always felt that when I use my last name, I can't use it without putting personalities ahead of principles. So I just don't happen to use my last name. But you have to have some identification. So everybody up there called me Shorty of White Salmon. And I was known as that pretty well up in the Northwest. And I was invited over to Spokane to talk once. And the lady got up and she says, "Our speaker tonight is going to be Whitey of Short Salmon." And being new at this speaking bit, it kind of threw me a little bit. It threw me almost as bad as going to Casper, Wyoming. I traveled for the Bill Hatch Sporting Goods people, and I traveled to Wyoming shortly after I came on the program. And I went into Casper, and I went over to this clubhouse they built there, a little bitty one, about 24 by 12 feet. And I wanted to find out where it was in case they had a meeting that night. And there was a car parked outside, and I went in. There was a lady there, and she said she was getting ready for the meeting that night. She was going to be chairman. And I said, "Well, that's fine. There's a meeting. I'm a traveling man. I travel for Bill Hatch Sporting Goods." And I'd like to be here. She says, "That's fine. That's wonderful. In fact, I wonder if you'd be willing to make a little talk." And I says, "Well, that could be done too, perhaps." So I got there that night. She got up and she says, "We really are fortunate. We don't very often see a stranger. And we have a man here tonight who travels out of Spokane for Bill Hatch Sporting Goods, and he sells sporting house equipment." And that was kind of hard to take, too. But I think the thing that concerns me most about giving a talk is that I can stop talking before you folks stop listening tonight. I'm perhaps as qualified as anybody can be when it comes to experiences. It was brought out very strongly to me back at Las Vegas at the Pacific Regional. I was chairing one of the panels, and John Mack, the delegate at that time from Los Angeles, and was on the panel, and he got up and he said they couldn't help but choose him to be on the panel because he was perhaps as qualified from a standpoint of experienced as anybody could be. He says, why shouldn't he be? He was the father of 6 children and 9 grandchildren, and gone through all the experiences of raising them and troubles and tribulations. He really qualified for being an experienced man. And after he sat down, I realized how wide the door had been opened. Because you see, my wife and I, we have 8 children. And we have 20 grandchildren. And John jumps up and he says, which only proves one thing. He says, that proves that I'm a good Catholic. In short, he's a sexy Protestant. But just because I've been invited here to talk doesn't really mean I'm a big shot. In fact, around home, I've been made very much aware of the fact that I'm not a big shot. I've done a lot of traveling in my day, and one night I come home with my briefcase and my suitcase and walked in the living room, and there's the wife and 2 of my daughters sitting there, and right in the middle of the living room is a brand new sewing machine. And I says, what's that? They says, it's a sewing machine. I says, whose sewing machine? It's our sewing machine. I says, who bought it? We did. How come I didn't know anything about it? We didn't think it was necessary. And I put my cases down and sat down, and I said to them, let's settle this once for all. Who's boss around here? My wife looked at me and she said, Shorty, I think it'd be a lot better if you never found out. I don't say much about my drinking past. I'm not against drunkologues. It just doesn't happen to be me to do that. I have my wife here with me, and if you want to know what kind of a bastard I was, she can tell you. She can tell you how she borrowed money so I could go down and pay the light bill, but I never got it paid, and they were home there in the cold in the middle of the winter in Minnesota with no lights and nothing to cook with because I had to drink. And they can tell you endless stories about that. I come to AA because I drank too damn much. That's why I came. As to when I got started, whether I was born an alcoholic or I acquired it, I crossed that invisible line, I don't know. There is so much to learn in AA, I've never had time to find out about that. I felt maybe I would be wasting my time if I did. I know this, that when I was a senior in high school, 3 of us guys decided to be a little more sensational than the rest in the class, and we bought a pint of pure alcohol and a quart of mix. We went to the class picnic. Just before we got there, we each slugged ourselves good, and we stashed it by a telephone pole. We went into the picnic grounds and played softball. 2 of us got real busy playing ball, and the other guy, he snuck back and helped himself to some. Then he came back and asked the other 2 if it wasn't about time we all had a drink, and we all went back and drank. And when they got busy, he snuck back for some more, and he kept doing that, and you know what happened. He passed out. The next thing he remembers, he's sitting in the superintendent of school's office with his dad, and his dad's trying to convince the superintendent that regardless of what his son did the day before, he should be allowed to graduate. Fortunately, my dad was a good talker, and I was allowed to graduate. Now, if I'd known then what we now know about alcoholics, I would have known that I was one of those individuals that would never get any good out of drinking, because I did something that was typical of the alcoholic. You don't think it's important, but it's an alcoholic trait, to be sure. I cheated on my best friends to get more than my share to drink. Now, I know I'm unique in that. I know none of the rest of you ever did that. But because of that, I rather think I'm an alcoholic, plus a few other things. I came to a point where I had to either get rid of myself or get rid of my drinking. Now, for your information, I didn't get rid of myself. I finally got rid of the drinking. I was met by three men. I had taken a couple shots at AA. My wife, one night when I came home, we lived in Spokane, and I crawled into bed, drunker and a goat. She said to me, "Shorty, do you think you could stop drinking if you wanted to?" And I says, "I don't know." She says, "Would you talk to Chestnut tomorrow?" Chestnut was the photographer for the store I worked in. And he was on AA. So I called Chestnut the next morning, and they took me up to the Alano Club in Spokane, and I ran a beautiful run up there. I stayed sober a little less than 30 days. Why I know it was a little less than 30 days was every Saturday night they called up anybody who had finally been sober for 1 month, and they give them a little button. And this was Saturday night, and I wouldn't have my 30 days until the next Tuesday night. Now, this Saturday was closer to Tuesday than the next Saturday would be, so I figured I should get my button that night. And I went up and got my button that night, and I didn't get my 30 days in. The next time, the credit service came to me and says, "We got a bunch of notices here where we should attach your paycheck, and I thought I'd talk to you first because we understood and you took a shot at AA here a while back, and we think perhaps if you'd go back up there again, maybe I could keep the wolves off for a little while." And of course, rather than get my paychecks all tied up, I was glad to go back up to the club, and I went up there for a little while. And that lasted just about another month. The next contact I had with AA was off 3rd and Minna Street in San Francisco. And I had three marvelous men come up to me about my drinking too much. One of them was Jack. They're all dead now, so I say their names. One of them was Jack Irving. The other was Holland Pyle. And the other was Ted Hunt. And Jack, I bumped into him, and he said, turned, looked at me, and he says, "Fella, you drink too much." And I says, "Who in the hell doesn't know that?" And he says, "Would you like to be sober?" I says, "Anybody'd like to be sober." He says, "That isn't what I asked you. I asked you if you'd like to be sober." I says, "You're talking to the wrong fella now. I've been every place through everything. I'm just one of those guys that don't get sober." He says, "I didn't even ask you if you thought you could get sober." I says, "Who are you, the Salvation Army or something?" He says, "No, we're just a couple, three guys looking over the old homestead." And he says, "You look so much like I must have looked." He says, "I thought I'd talk to you." And I haven't had a drink since. And that was January 23rd, 1949. And Jack talked. I got awfully sick sober now. But Jack talked to me. And the first thing he said to me was, "Can you go 24 hours without a drink?" I says, "What the hell good's that going to do?" He says, "I asked you if you could go 24 hours without a drink." I says, "Fella, 24 hours ain't going to handle this situation. You don't know what a sweat I'm in, fella. You don't know the problems I got. 24 hours ain't a drop in the bucket towards what I've got to have to get any place." He says, "You still haven't answered me. Can you go 24 hours without a drink?" I said, "I can do that standing on my head." He says, "That won't be necessary." He got me to AA meetings at the Bush Street at the downtown group under the French Catholic Church there in San Francisco. And I went to the meeting there. And I had resigned myself to not like AA. The bastards always talked about God and something spiritual and stuff like that. And I'd come to a point in my life where this God business was about the most hardest to understand thing there was in the world. I'd been brought up in a family that prayed. I had been taught to pray. I had attended lots of church. And look what a mess God made out of me. And it was pretty hard to reconcile all the things that have happened to me with this love and compassion and kindness and forgiveness that those guys were talking about. And I started to figure I was in the wrong place. And I was about to leave. But I didn't. Some of the things that Jack told me are still with me. He said, there's three things, Shorty, you're going to have to do. One is, you're going to have to attend meetings regularly. The second thing is, you're going to have to help others and help the group. The third thing is, you're going to have to get a hold of a big book and start reading it. Prior to this, maybe my continuity in talking to you tonight isn't going to be so good. But just prior to this, I was talking to Jack about this 24-hour business, and that's when he said a thing that I've repeated many times. I says, how am I going to get any sobriety if all you talk about is 24 hours? And then that's when he said, did you ever eat a steak? And I says, sure. He says, I suppose you're the kind of a person that just took the steak in your hands and stuffed it in your mouth and tried to swallow it. And I says, what do you think I am, a damn fool? He says, we'll talk about that later. But of course you didn't, he says. He says, you're just like everybody else. You picked up the knife and fork and you cut off a piece and you chewed it and you swallowed it. And you weren't worried one bit whether you finished that steak. All you were concerned about is you didn't cut off a piece too big to chew and swallow. You knew the steak would be gone as long as you paid attention to that. And he says, that's the way this program works. The average alcoholic can only bite off 24 hours at a time or he'll choke on it. And I've always remembered that. And then once when we were talking about meetings, we were sitting up there in the Alano Club, and I was sitting with Jack there, and they were going to have a party that night, a Halloween dance, and they were decorating it with cornstalk and pumpkins and corn ears and stuff, and the whole thing was getting decorated, and except one little place over there. There was a pedestal over there on the wall, and I says, for Christ's sake, Jack, why don't they get a pumpkin or something on that pedestal? That looks awful bare. He says, they won't put nothing on that. I says, why? He says, it's reserved. I says, what is it reserved for? He says, for the statue of the first person that makes a program without attending meetings. And then I got a job. $22 a week. Part-time dishwasher at the Golden Pheasant. The first payday I got of $22, Jack come along and he took 3.5 off of it and bought a big book for me. Oh, that hurt. I couldn't see at all taking $3.5 out of a lousy little paycheck like that. But you know, that night when I went to bed, I figured he knew what he was doing because I started reading the big book. And I started learning something about AA. And I got it the way Jack said I should get it, straight from the horse's mouth. And that's the way you get it when you read the big book. Now this big book has got the answers. It reminds me, you know, sometimes we think we can do it a little different. We figure we don't quite have to do it that way. Did you ever get a guy that you didn't think was quite ready to go to a meeting, that you wanted to consult with him a little while first, 2-3 times before he was ready to take to a meeting? Can you ever remember one of those guys that stayed sober? I can't. But I can sure remember the guys that I didn't care what shape they were. I drug them down to the meeting and planted their fanny on a chair, told them to listen. I know a lot of those guys that stayed sober. You know, I sold athletic equipment in Wyoming, and at the time, this was in 1951, and Bill Cumming had a new ball. They just started to use rubber-covered balls instead of leather balls in those days for football and basketball in the high schools, because it was less expensive and they didn't get ruined when they got wet. And we were selling an awful lot of rubber-covered balls. And I went out there and went to selling them, and they give me, the Seamless Rubber Corporation gave me a catalog and instructions of how to use it. And the instructions were that I was supposed to go into that superintendent or the buyer of school and to take a chair and put it over beside him, put it right over beside him, and sit down and open up this book and start showing him the pictures and reading what it said under each picture. And I did that. And when I got done, the man would say, usually I'll take a couple dozen of that and a dozen of this, and give me half a gross of that and give me 6 of that. And I got away from that first customer with my quota for the whole day and then some. And I went to the next school and I did the same thing, and they says, I'll take a dozen of that, 2 dozen of that, 4 dozen. I'll take next year's supply. And before the week was out, I had my month's quota sold. And I kept going around the state selling until the boss started getting worried about whether the orders were good or not. So he met me, and I left Evanston, and he met me in Salt Lake City. And Bill was there in the Utah hotel, and I went up to the room, and he was laying there on the bed, and he says, how are you, Shorts? And I says, fine. He says, all those orders you took, are they good? I says, they absolutely are. He says, well, Jim, the sales manager, thinks they got to be phony. There's too many of them, and they're too big. I says, no, Bill, everyone's a good order, and it proved eventually it was. Well, I got to be the best seller of rubber balls in that whole area. The next year, I was transferred over to Oregon, and I started going through Oregon, and I didn't take my little book out of my grip. I sat down opposite the superintendent, and I told him all about this wonderful line of goods we had. And he says, well, I'll take one of those to try it, and I'll take one of those to try it, and I'll take another one over here to try it. And he says, if they're as good as you say they are, why, we might buy a lot of them next year. And I go to the next one, same story. I couldn't figure out. Here, the year before, I had been selling just scads of it, and here I couldn't even sell enough for gas money. I was laying there in one of the towns one night, and I began to realize what I'd done. So the next day I got to a school, I took out that old dusty catalog, and I took the chairman, put it around beside the superintendent, and I opened up the book and showed him the pictures, and I read the lines, and when I was done, he says, I'll take a dozen of those, and a dozen of that, and a dozen of them. I'd gotten too smart to go by the book. That's never happened to you folks with AA book, I'm sure. I go to meetings because I don't dare not to. I don't think there's 5 weeks in the entire AA life of mine that have gone by without me being to at least one meeting. Somehow or other, I picture meeting places as filling stations. And I think of myself as a vehicle that's got to be filled every so often, or I'll run dry, I'll run out of gas. I know I can pass a few service stations, but I can't keep passing them without getting in trouble with my car. And I might can pass up a few meetings now and then, but I'm awful sure I can't keep passing them up, or I'm going to run out of AA insurance. I'm as sure of that as I stand here. I believe that implicitly. And so I attend meetings. Now, if some of you are new on AA, and that's the only ones I'm talking to be honest with you, you new folks, you might think that you're a little bit too phony to join AA. But just because you want to come, you're not too phony. You know, when I joined AA, I didn't have a job. I didn't have any money. And I used to look up the list of meetings in San Francisco to find out which one served donuts or cake after the meeting, because I wouldn't be caught dead at a meeting didn't serve food after it, because I was having a tough time. Now, you can call that being phony if you want to, and I think maybe it was a little bit, but I got to the meetings and I stayed sober. So don't worry about whether you're phony or not. I've been going to AA for a while, and one day Kellis come up to me, if you folks remember the name of the lawyer that became a judge in San Francisco, and he says, I want you to meet a friend of mine. And I met him, and he says, he's going to speak at the big hall Wednesday night, and I want you to be sure there to be there, Shorty. He says, he's a real pillar in AA. Of course, I wanted to hear a pillar in AA, so I went, and he made a beautiful talk. And about a month later, I was invited over to Sausalito to talk at their group over there, and it went pretty good. And on the way back, George Gore said to me, that's pretty good, Shorty. And I thought, I'm on my way. I'm going to be a pillar in AA for sure now. I made a talk. But you know, we get some rude awakenings on this program if we get honest with ourselves, and I soon discovered that that wasn't the meat of the thing at all. And then they made me chairman of the institution committee that took care of going over to San Quentin every Sunday morning, and they only allowed five in each Sunday morning then. And I was the one assigned to pick the five and go over there. And there was at least 100 each week that wanted to go, and I would select the five. And I really knew I had a real important job in AA. And I attached that to the fact that maybe that was contributing to me being a pillar. But you know, my year of office ran out, and they had to hunt like hell to find somebody to take my place. So that kind of let me down a little bit. You often hear the remark, stick with the winners. Well, at the L&O Club in San Francisco in those days was a long table along one side, and they were newcomers there, all of them were, and I would go over to that table and sit down with them, and one guy named Chester, I could remember him well, and he would be sober for a couple months, and then he'd get drunk, and then he'd come back. And we'd sit at that table during a couple weeks there. There'd always be somebody the gang knew real well that we're going to take another shot at the program. And there wasn't anybody in that bunch that talked about a year's sobriety or anything like that. They were always talking about the drunks, the slips they had. So I was sitting there, and I looked across the room over there, and I said to him, who are those guys at that table over there? They says, well, you don't want to know them. I says, why? He says, they've been sober so long they forgot what it means to drink. Some of them have been sober 4-5 years. So I got up, and I walked over there and asked him, is there room for me to sit down? Sure, have a chair. Do you want a cup of coffee? And I sat down with those guys, and one of the guys says, can we help you? I says, yeah, I'd like to ask you a question. And they says, what do you want to know? I says, how come you guys stay sober so long? They says, we're glad you asked. And they included me with them, and they talked to me, and I got lots of good advice from them, lots of encouragement. And I'm as sure as I'm standing here that if I'd sat with the slippers and hadn't gone over and sat with the winners, I wouldn't have stayed sober. You new folks coming on, don't figure because there's some of us old fogies that have been around a long while, don't figure that you don't belong here or have nothing to contribute. I think sometimes we're very guilty of it. We think just because they've been drinking for 3-4 years that they don't know what it's all about. It reminds me of the story of John the Evangelist. He was getting pretty old, but he'd had tent meetings for years and great crowds would come and he saved thousands of souls. And he just knew that when he got to heaven, there would be a special place for him for all he'd done for God. So one day he died and he went to heaven. He knocked on St. Peter's door and St. Peter stuck his nose out and says, "Just a minute, I'm busy right now." And he made him sit down in the vestibule there and wait. While he was waiting, a Jewish rabbi came in and knocked at the door, and St. Peter opened it and says, "Come on in, Isaac." That kind of bothered him, but he didn't know too much about the Jewish faith, so he let that go by. And a little while later, a cardinal of the Catholic Church came, and he says, "Come on in, Tom." Well, he didn't let that bother him too much either. But then there come a little 16-year-old blonde. She knocked on the door, and St. Peter opened and says, "Come right on in, Mary." John couldn't take that. A little 16-year-old getting ahead of him. So he went and knocked on the door, and St. Peterson says, "I'm not ready." "Yeah," John says, "just answer one question." "I didn't mind the priest and the rabbi getting in, but that 16-year-old girl getting in ahead of me, isn't that too much?" "Oh, you don't know Mary?" He says, "No, I don't know Mary." He says, "Well, Mary had a birthday just a month ago. And she got a brand new sport car for her birthday. And just a little while ago, she drove too fast around a corner and hit a telephone pole. And it ended it for her, and that's why she's here." He says, "Yeah, but what's that got to do with her getting in so quick?" He says, "John, I hoped I didn't have to tell you this. But that little gal Mary, in the 30 days she drove that sports car, put the fear of God in more people than you have in all your ministry." So you young people, if you think you're getting crowded out a little bit, just remember that and tell it to them. I've learned as much from young people as I've learned from old timers, I'll tell you that. You know, I said that I almost left AA because of two things: their mention of God, their spiritual particularly, and because of the prayers. This word spiritual bothered me, and one day in San Francisco I thought I was going to find out what it meant, and I walked up to the library and I started looking through the dictionaries, and I had 22 dictionaries lined up on that table, and I had them all opened up to the word spiritual. And I started reading the definitions. And when I got done, I found 7 of them said the same thing. And these 7 that I picked out said, all things that are not material are spiritual. And boy, did that ever put a different picture on this word spiritual. It was no longer a religious experience. It was something I could understand. To tell the truth would be a spiritual act. To be kind would be a spiritual act. To be tolerant would be a spiritual act. To be open-minded would be a spiritual act. All those things AA was suggesting to me as a way of recovery didn't have anything material about them at all. So they just had to be spiritual. So finally, when I come to that part that said, having had a spiritual awakening, I knew what it meant. It didn't mean I had been converted or had a white flash. It mean that I had become awakened to the fact that only good would come to me if I would be honest and kind and compassionate and open-minded and tolerant and all those spiritual acts, I could have a spiritual life. And I had been awakened by the steps that these things were good for me. And I finally overcome the prayer situation. You know, I didn't say a prayer there in San Francisco for several weeks. I just couldn't. I had never got any place with prayer at all. And you know, one night I was walking down Bush Street, down the hill towards the old club, and all of a sudden Providence stepped in. Now, I believe in Providence. And I know he stepped in and he made me realize one thing. And that was, with all these people talking about prayer and exercising prayer and all that, there wasn't a single one of them that ever told me they got hurt by prayer. And oh boy, how many of them told me they got helped by it. You know, when you're a con artist, and which Elkie isn't, he can't turn down odds like that. Those are terrific odds. Not a chance to get hurt and maybe a chance to get a lot of help. What could I hurt myself praying? It couldn't hurt me. And you know, some of these guys might have something when they say it can help you. And so with that conclusion, the next meeting night, I condescended to say the Lord's Prayer with the rest of them. And I've been saying it ever since, and I've been saying a lot of other prayers. And prayer is a terrific part of this program. I don't think my wife has ever heard me tell this, but I think she can recall, it has to be true. Before I get up in the morning, I always say a little prayer along the lines, as the definition in AA is for prayer: ask for guidance, knowledge of God's will, and the power to carry it out. And I do this before I get up. And I absolutely believe that it's an important part of my day. I believe it so strongly, I've jumped out of bed and got half dressed and realized I hadn't, and I've undressed and jumped back into bed and said my prayer. That's how important I feel prayer is. But of course, you can pray too much too. You want to be careful with a powerful weapon like that. You perhaps heard about the two ministers up in Prosser, Washington. Nice little town. Should be nice. Those two ministers were so diligent that they'd chased all the sin out of the town. There just wasn't any sin there. And they were standing downtown one morning, and there was a guy driving some grade stakes in an empty lot across the street, and they wanted to know what he was building. Nobody knew. So they went over to the courthouse, and he says, well, the guy's building a saloon. He says, he can't do that in our town. He says, well, you can't stop him. Oh, yes, we can. So they went out in the street and says, as long as the law won't help, we'll have God help us. So they both resigned themselves to call the congregations together each Thursday night and start praying. Pray for nothing but to eliminate that man from their community. And they started praying, and they prayed, and they prayed while the man put the foundation in. And they prayed while the man put the studdings up and the bracing. They prayed while the man put the rafters on, and they prayed while he put the roof on. And they prayed while he was putting all the fixtures in, and they were getting a little doubtful. But they kept praying, and there he announced his grand opening, and they just wondering about God now. This guy just couldn't open that joint. And they went to bed that night awfully worried, but they woke up about 2 o'clock, the fire siren was going off in town. And they went downtown to see what was happening, and here's this new saloon, all afire, burning to the ground. And the one minister looked over at the other one and didn't say anything, with a little smirk on his face. They knew what had happened. But they weren't smiling about 3 days later, when a lawyer for the saloon keeper served him with papers saying that they caused his building to be burned. So they hired a lawyer to defend themselves, and they got into court, and the lawyer for the plaintiff said that because of these men's action in their church, They caused my client's building to burn down. And we want $75,000. The lawyer for the ministers got up and said, by no stretch of the imagination are they going to be able to prove that they did anything to cause that building to burn. The judge looked at the two lawyers and he called them up front. He says, fellas, you really got me confused. Here I got a saloon keeper believing in prayer and two ministers who don't. Providence has come forth on several occasions. Again, when I was traveling back in Wyoming, and I wish Alabama was here tonight to hear this, I was at Gillette, Wyoming, and it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was hot. Oh, and I'd been away from home for about 5 weeks, and my wife and I had just gotten together recently before that. I'd been sober long enough for her to believe I might mean it. And I had to get to Buffalo, about 90 miles away. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was lonesome, and I'd have to stay a weekend in a little town, and I didn't like it very well, and I started driving down the road, and I knew sooner got driving than there was a great big billboard on the side of the road, and it says, "Meet you at Alabama's." And I drove another 10 miles, and there's a great big sign. There ain't a beer you can name that we haven't got at Alabama's. And we ran another 10 miles, and he says, we can mix any drink there is at Alabama's. Every 10 miles, a sign. There was one that says, nobody's ever lonesome at Alabama's. And another said, you'll always have friends at Alabama's. And you know, somehow or other, I wasn't heading for the school at Buffalo. I was heading for Alabama's. There is no other place in the world I wanted to go except to Alabama's. And I got to Buffalo, and there's a big Y on the road, one down to the town where Alabama's was and the other over to the school. And that stinking old Chevrolet automobile of mine turned over to the school. And I walked in the back door, and Superintendent Stevens was standing at the top of the stairs. He looked down at me and he says, what in the world's the matter with you? He knew I belonged to AA. I says, Alabama's got me. He says, I know what you mean. Now you talk about Providence. He asked me where I was going to stay, and I told him the motel. And after a little while, he came with the coach, and we went out to dinner together. And we went back to my motel, and the two Smith boys that are on AA, and one other guy was there, and they were getting ready to play two-bit poker, and they played two-bit poker with me until 2 o'clock in the morning, so they were sure Alabama's was closed. And you think I don't believe in Providence. A lot of things have happened to me in AA that were rough. It said you got to get rid of your old ideas, and they never registered with me. But it's true. I had to get rid of some old ideas, and they were tough to get rid of. And principle among all of them was I had to get rid of my old idea of God. That was it. Getting rid of your old ideas, that meant that to me more than anything else. And then I began wondering about AA and the organization of AA and what there was about AA, what made it so different. And then something dawned on me. We are so unique, you can't believe it. Can you name another organization in the whole wide world where you got to have something wrong with you in order to belong? You got to be just a little bit of a bastard to belong to AA in some form or another. or you're not going to get in. Defects of character have to be coming out all over to make you eligible. So I began thinking maybe that's the reason we're different. And then I wondered why it was that with all the things they'd tried on me, why it was they worked. And I remembered the time that I went to a minister and talked to him about it and listened to what he said would be the results of my continued drinking, and he didn't scare me a bit because I just went out and got drunk again. And my old doctor told me, he says, "Shorty, you're going to have cirrhosis of the liver. You keep drinking." And who in the hell's scared of cirrhosis of the liver? I wasn't. I kept drinking. And I had a psychiatrist talk to me. Mr. Lindsay, a good friend of mine, sent me to a psychiatrist. And that psychiatrist told me if I didn't stop drinking, I might be like several others. I'd go to a mental institution. But that didn't scare me. And then, right at the time I was coming on, a pill came out in San Francisco. A doctor was experimenting with it, and we had a chance to take it. I didn't take it, but they told me that if I'd take that, I wouldn't dare drink, because I'd have a convulsion or I would die, maybe. I didn't take the pill, but I saw a lot of people that didn't scare either. Then I went to AA, and I have managed to stay sober, and I have tried to figure out why. And I know why. They didn't threaten me with anything if I drank. They told me how good it was going to be sober. And they told it to me, and I started believing it, and something has happened to me that if you told me when I first come on it happened, I'd tell you you were crazy. It just couldn't be possible. It's fun to be sober. It's real fun to be sober. Can you imagine anything like that to happen to an alcoholic? But it does in AA. And we should be grateful. I thought many times about this spiritual part of the program. There isn't any other part, but I thought about it many times. I had trouble with it. And I had a chance to get a job up in Marysville, California once. And I didn't get it, and I was pretty despondent, and I drove out in the country a little ways between in a great big peach orchard. A little road going through it. It was a hot day. And as I was sitting there feeling sorry for myself, here come a little bitty crawler tractor under those trees through the orchard. And there was no leaves on the trees yet. It was the spring of the year. And on that was a little farmer. He was an Oriental. He was Japanese. And he was sitting there with nothing but a pair of Levi's on. He didn't have a shirt, hat, nothing, and the dust was just flying all over. He was getting awfully dirty. And behind him a little ways was another, his son or his brother or something, with a shovel, and he was digging around the peach trees to make room for the irrigation water to get in close. And he was dirty and dusty. And these guys were doing this so they could have peaches, and there wasn't a single peach on the tree. And I wondered, what kind of guys are they? What is it about them? Here they'll come and they'll cultivate this ground and they'll water it and they'll spray it and they'll thin the trees. They'll just do everything. They'll fertilize the ground. They're doing everything and they don't see no peaches. All they do is because they know that something inside that tree is going to happen. That fertilizer and that dirt and that water is going to come up through the trunk of that tree and end up with a beautiful peach out on the end of the limb. They have no comprehension of how this is going to take place, but they know it will. They are absolutely sure it's going to take place. They know to the extent that they're honest with that tree. They know if they forget to spray, regardless of how many other things they do, they won't have a saleable peach. They can do everything and forget to water and they won't have a peach. They know they've got to do every single thing they honestly know is good for that tree. And then they'll have a harvest. I sat there. Now, if this guy upstairs is so meticulous about his attention to a stinking old tree, maybe he's meticulous about being paying attention to me, too, if I will start being honest with myself about myself. And I figured out to the extent that I was willing to be honest, to the extent that I was willing to be tolerant, and to the extent I was willing to be kind, and to be open-minded, and to have compassion, to that extent good was going to happen to me. And I believe that to this day. It worried me a little while that maybe I hadn't reached my bottom. You know, I believe we use a lot of words we shouldn't use in AA, and this bottom business kind of irritated me. You know, your guy goes out and gets drunk because he wasn't quite sure he'd reached his bottom yet. Well, you know what that's like, don't you? It's just like going out here in the yard and start digging a hole. You dig it a foot deep and you want to get out. It isn't very hard to get out, but you know where you get out from, don't you? You're getting out from the bottom. You dig it 4 foot deep and you get out, you'll have it a little tougher getting out, but you're still getting out from the bottom. You can dig it 8 feet deep and you'll have a heck of a time getting out because of bottom. You're getting out from the bottom and you can get that bottom so deep it'll cave in on you. But I don't care where you go from. It's your bottom. Anytime you want to go up, you're going up from the bottom. And don't let this idea that there's a certain plateau that you have to be at before Providence is going to do anything for you. Providence is not that cruel. And I'm glad that so many are realizing that they don't have to do the things I did and they don't have to do the things a lot of us did before they're willing to say uncle. I sometimes say I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. And I mean that. I am glad I'm an alcoholic. There's nothing in God's world except alcohol that could have made me say uncle. And there was nothing that was going to make a good life for me until I did. So I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I've never had the stigma of the word ever adversely affect me. I don't think there is any stigma to the word. I think there's only two kinds of alcoholics, and that's the drunk ones and the sober ones. And the drunk ones can have the stigma because the sober ones aren't going to have it. Well, I went along in AA. They told me I had to talk for 2.5 hours. It's going to be a hell of a struggle, I'll tell you that. I kept going along in AA, and some nice things happened to me. I entered into the field of service in AA. And that's a beautiful experience. I had become the delegate, and I came back to make my report to my own home group, and there was quite a crowd there, and I gave my talk. And afterwards, one of the guys, a new guy, had been on about a week, he says, "What's a GSR? And I says, "He's a general service representative. He's selected by his group to represent them and to be their servant." He says, "Oh, you mean it's politics?" I says, "No." He says, "My sponsor told me that was politics. I should be careful about it." And there Providence entered in, and Providence said to me to tell him this, "Fella, anyone who calls service politics don't want to be of service." And I believe that. I think service is an important part of this program. And I think the GSRs are the most important people as far as the service structure is concerned. I look at this whole service structure like a tent. Great big 3-ring circus. And those gray poles inside, like trustees and delegates, sticking up there in the air, majestic in every way, and the big umbrella of area service and organization, which is the tent itself. And then all around the outside, and little bitty pegs with little ropes attached to them, all around that tent. And that's your GSRs. And if you don't think they're important, go inside and push on one of those big poles and see how much moves. But you go outside and start kicking those little pegs loose, and you don't have very many loose before you've got a catastrophe on your hands. There ain't no more tent show, I'll guarantee you that. And that's just what GSRs are to the service structure. They're the ones that hold it up. I remember my first birthday. I and a guy named Ted came there to Bush Street for the meeting that night, and we were both having our birthday. I was washing dishes. And Ted had got his old job back as superintendent of the plumbing company he worked for, and he was there with a brand new car, a new girlfriend. They'd just been out looking at a new house in Sausalito. And I looked at him and all the things that had happened to him, and I looked at me and saw how miserable I was having it, and I thought, quit kidding yourself, Shorty. This AA isn't for you. Just look how it treats you. Here's Ted. Goes to one meeting a week, and you go to a meeting every day. Ted's got the car. Ted's got the house. Ted's got the good job on one meeting a week. And you can't even be dealt a decent job on seven meetings a week. And I got up and left the meeting before they could give me my button. And I started down towards the club to get my stuff so I could get drunk. And on the way down there, that old stinker Providence stuck its nose in my business again. Says, what are you feeling sorry for yourself for? Do you ever figure how fortunate you are? Where were you a year ago today? You didn't have a friend in the world. You didn't know where to go. You were hardly employable. You were miserable. Why, you're 1,000 times better off today than you were a year ago. What's the matter with you? Quit comparing yourself with other people and start comparing yourself with what you were. And as long as I compare myself with what I've been, I can find a lot of merit in this program. But I don't want to ever compare myself with anybody else's progress in the program. I learned another thing from Chellis that was very valuable. I was washing dishes, $22 a week as a part-time dishwasher, having a heck of a time getting by. And I went up to Chellis one day and I said to him, Chellis, what's the score on this AA anyway? I go to a meeting every night and I can hardly get enough to eat. He says, how good a dishwasher are you? I says, what's that got to do with it? He says, plenty. I says, what do you mean, plenty? He says, you can't expect anything better to happen to you until you become the best dishwasher they ever had at the Golden Peasant. Well, I, with a little tongue-in-cheek, I think, I went back to the Golden Peasant and I started, instead of polishing the silver once a week, I did it 2-3 times a week. Instead of making the girls come down that long stairs to get their plates and stuff for the station, I carried them up the stairs and put them at the table at the top of the stairs. They started sharing their tips with me because I did this. I started helping the second cook clean his pots, and I got a little putty knife, and I started scraping the goo out from the angle iron, that old dishwashing machine. And I washed the wall behind the dishwashing machine. I don't think it had been washed for 20 years. And I had things looking beautiful. One day, Mr. Williams, the owner, came down and he says, "Don't tell anybody what my first name is, please." He called me by my first. He says, Harold. He says, "I hate to lose you." And I thought, what the heck have I done now? I says, "What's the matter?" He says, "Well, the trouble is I've been trying to get you a job upstairs in the pantry," he says, "but the union won't let me. There's too many people out of work." And he says, "So I'm going to lose you." I says, "Am I getting canned?" "No. But you aren't going to be here very long." And I says, "Why?" He says, "You're the best dishwasher we ever had in this place, and they don't stay around very long." And within a week, I was invited to come to Hastings Clothes and sell clothes on the floor. And I believe that to this day, that we have to exercise honest stewardship in whatever we do if we expect anything better to come. We live in the land of someday so much that we forget to take care of today. And that's in regards to AA or our job or anything. And I'll forever be grateful to Kellis for that lesson. Everybody that comes on AA gets some little sayings that they attach themselves to. And I have some that I have to reach for quickly. And one thing I've been grateful for, besides these sayings, is this. That AA didn't patch my life up. It didn't do a single bit of repairing on me. It gave me a new life. And I'm thankful for it. If they'd taken patched that old life up, there'd been something blowing out or going to pieces every little once in a while. There's nobody that could have repaired that thing so it'd be fit to travel in. And I believe with anybody that comes on the program, they'll come on it honestly. I think they will be given a new life. And I think that's beautiful. I think that gives us faith in this thing. I think one of the greatest problems we have in AA is that we find in its simplicity is our difficulty. We want to make things complicated. I couldn't imagine with all my problems that something as simple as this was going to solve them. Do you know what that man said would solve my problems? He says, "Can you go 24 hours without a drink?" Now that's too asinine simple to do anything. But that's where our problem is. It's in it. We have our difficulty with its simplicity. And I say that to myself lots of times. And a lot of times I say to myself when I think I'm the only bugger that isn't permitted to drink, I do some entertaining and traveling. And I'm getting caught sometimes and feeling sorry for myself because I can't drink. And I'm paying for these drinks for these other guys. And you know, that isn't fair. And then's when I have to say to myself, the most dishonest act an alcoholic can perform is to take a drink. And I believe that implicitly. And when I think I've got some brainstorm idea that's going to help one of these alcoholics, and I'm too lazy to take them to a meeting, or I think I've got a smarter way of doing it, I have a little thing I say to myself about that. I say to myself, when you follow the rule, you do pretty good as a rule. But when you follow the exception, you don't do so good as a rule. And I believe that. I became the delegate. And in driving home, I all of a sudden realized that I'd become a pillar in AA. God, I was one of 91 people in the whole North American continent. You just had to be a pillar. There was no way out of it. But by the time I got home, that little stinker stuck his nose in my business and made me realize that maybe if there weren't any delegates, we'd still have AA. And so that one was tossed out the window too. One day in Portland, I was invited, a young girl, she was going to lead the meeting at the Northwest Conference, and the topic for the meeting, she was going to call on people, and they were going to tell me, all they were going to do was tell her what happiness is in AA. And I knew her quite well, and I knew she was going to call on me eventually, and boy, I didn't know what to say. How in the heck are you going to answer it? People talk about getting their wives back, and some of them talk how lucky they were they didn't get their old wife back. And oh, there was all kinds of things they said, and then finally she called on me. And I was just up in front when I began realizing what real happiness has been to me in AA. And I may imagine I'm unique in this. Do you know what the real happiness in AA has been to me? It's been not being afraid to answer the telephone. Not being afraid to open my mail. Not being afraid to answer the door. Not being afraid to walk down any street I choose for fear of who I might meet. I spent more of my life in fear of those four things than anything else in the world. And I don't have them anymore. So that's what happiness is to me in AA. I was going up the Yakima Valley one evening. It was a Sunday evening. And I heard there was a meeting in a little town of Toppenish on Sunday evening. And I drove over to where this meeting was. And there was a light in the window. There was this little old rundown store beside the railroad tracks. And I went to the door and went in, and there sat Harry, 5 foot wide and 5 foot tall, a full-blooded Indian. And he was sitting in a chair behind the desk, immaculate. You couldn't have been more clean and neat than Harry was. And he was all alone in there, and there was all the literature on the table, and there was a percolator of coffee, and half a dozen donuts there. And he says, "Hi, Shorty." I says, "Hi, Harry. Am I early?" And he says, "No." I says, "Where's everybody?" And he says, "I guess we're here." I says, "Do you mean it'll just be you and me?" And he says, "Yeah, chances are." I says, "Don't you have anybody else at your meeting?" "Oh, they come up from Prosser and over from Yakima and Sunnyside once in a while. But a lot of times I sit here alone." I says, "Do you get ready like this every night?" "Yeah." "How long you been sober, Harry?" "9 years." "And you've been doing this?" "Yeah." "How many of your Indian friends have come to you for help in 9 years? He says, "5. I says, "And you keep this open like this?" He says, "Yeah." I says, "Why?" He says, "The book tells me I must carry the message, and this is the only way I know how." You know, in all my travels, I finally run into one of the real pillars in AA. Thank you.